Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The United States leads the industrialized world in population growth rate. A report by the Population Reference Bureau says the U.S. will maintain third place in overall growth rate, well ahead of Europe's, a problem we share with many developing nations. We'll have the story. Also, Larry Somke gets rid of his compost right into the garden. And Johnson Controls in Milwaukee wins a major award for lighting energy efficiency, says manager Douglas Decker.
In our own facilities, we have 10 million square foot of office space, and we've already realized a $340,000 a year savings.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. How many are coming to the party, and when will they arrive? These would be two questions anyone hosting a gathering would want to know. These are questions Carl Haub asks and studies for answers as a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau. The party in this case is world population. Haub says it's going to be a big party.
90 million people a year are added to world population, and that's exactly the same as adding one Mexico, our nearest neighbor, every single year. Mexico has about 90 million people, and that's what we have to accommodate. That works out to about a quarter of a million people every single day. When you think of numbers like that, they would fill five football stadiums, for example, and a typical football stadium in the U.S. A quarter of a million mouths every day, and the thing of it is most of those are in the developing countries.
Most, but certainly not all, as a recent report indicates, rather surprisingly. More in a moment. Recently, the Clinton administration announced restoration of U.S. funds to the United Nations Population Program, cut by Presidents Reagan and Bush. The announcement signals a renewed awareness that population growth patterns in the United States are part of the problem, not the solution, worldwide. The announcement made by Undersecretary of State Tim Wirth was timely, coming shortly after the release of a new study on population prepared by Carl Haub at the Population Reference Bureau in Washington. Haub says his studies show the United States should not be pointing fingers when either present or future global population is discussed.
Presently, world population stands at 5.5 billion after having reached the 5 billion plateau only back in 1987, only about 6 years ago. So in that rather short span of time, we've added another 500 million people.
What is critical about understanding that growth pattern? In other words, where is the growth taking place?
Virtually all of world population growth is taking place in the developing countries, what we sometimes refer to as the third world. We have two completely different demographic worlds. Today, we have the industrialized countries whose birth rates have been very low for quite a long time. Most of the countries of Europe, for example, will soon see population decline as the number of births they have each year drops below the annual number of deaths. Population growth in the developing countries is not likely to stop for many, many, many decades. And at the present, we certainly don't know how long that would take.
The study of demographics is a little like trying to plan a dinner party, figuring out how many guests you can invite, where they will sit, and how much food to prepare. But what if you did not know how many people were planning to attend? What if you had to plan on having some unexpected guests drop by? Well, this is what Haub and other demographers deal with. They study population growth patterns, trying to forecast how many people are coming to the party and when they will arrive. Haub says we should not make the mistake of assuming the party in the United States, however, is under control.
Overall, in the industrialized countries, the annual growth rate is only about 0.4% per year. But a lot of that is because the United States is included. The European growth rate is 0.2%, virtually zero. The U.S. actually is the only industrialized country that's adding really significant numbers each year.
And why is that?
Primarily because of our larger population size, of the fact that our birth rate jumped a few years ago, and because new immigration legislation now allows in a larger number of people each year. we now are letting in about 900,000 people each year on a net basis. Where some people leave the U.S. every year, some people arrive here. But we add almost 1 million people a year through immigration.
What this means is that current immigration rates are now close to what they were at the height of the immigrations at the early part of this century. Combining immigration rates and the birth-death rate, the report suggests the population of the United States, already growing by 3 million a year, will reach 383 million by 2050. Again, as we mentioned, the impact of population increases depends on where and how our numbers are distributed. To use our party analogy, suppose we have a large mansion and invite 100 people. Suppose there are several dining rooms and gardens for the guests to visit. We would hardly notice 100 people wandering around our home. Suppose, though, we have an apartment and invited those 100 people. Suppose. According to Haub's report, world population will not be spread out on the leisurely grounds of an estate. Where it is crowded now will become more so, while open spaces will tend to remain open.
Well, I think one of the major concerns is whether or not the developing countries will be able to maintain a sustainable development. We know that the developing countries are going to grow from about 4 billion today to possibly 10 or 12 billion by about the middle of the next century. That is a huge and unprecedented increase in population size. I mean, something like this has simply never happened before. One of the big questions is, to what extent will those countries be able to develop economically and to do so without damaging the environment and to properly feed, house, and clothe people? These are issues that have been around for quite some time. But not until the numbers really start getting large, and that's what they're going to do, are many of these issues really going to come to the fore in a big way.
What emerges then from this study is a projection of the future, where world population grows mainly in developing nations and the United States. While the United States and most of the developing world share this population growth problem then, Haub says the United States, with advanced technology and a stronger economy, has certain other responsibilities.
We should certainly, I think, assist these countries in slowing down their population growth rates when they want to. It's been a big debate, of course, for many, many, many years that the rich nations should not simply encourage the poorer nations to slow down in population growth without perhaps reducing some of their own consumption. The U.S., in fact, does give about $300 million in population assistance overseas, as do many industrialized countries. So it seems that we're fairly well involved in assisting countries that wish it. What is more difficult to see is how some of their needs will be taken care of in the future, particularly as regards food. It's going to be tricky, for example, in India, to add another 800 million people to that country or maybe more, and to be able to keep up a good level of nutrition and infant care. I would imagine in the future that the U.S. and many European countries will probably become much more directly involved in giving assistance of that nature, very basic assistance.
How many billions of us will there be in the future? If we could know for sure, we could start planning. Not knowing exactly, which is the situation we face, means we will face daunting challenges in the future to provide food, water, health services, education, and such to all.
The raw numbers of what we can expect in a medium sense are about 12 billion people by around the middle of the next century. That's the medium projection. We can be fairly sure that there would be about 8 billion people by the year 2025. The only thing of it is the further out you go, the less and less sure one can be about what ultimate population size might be. In fact, it could easily get up to about 30 billion by the end of the next century with almost no trouble at all. That's just the simple mathematics of population growth, you know, and compound interest.
Though the United States stands alone in the industrialized world posting a growth rate, the developing world, Haub says, is likely to show some surprising changes itself.
Well, it's certainly true that a lot of the future population growth will concentrate itself where the concentrations are now. There will be some changes. Africa, which is in some ways, but it's a somewhat thinly populated continent, will definitely not be thinly populated in the future and is going to take a much larger share of world population. So Africa will have a much larger role in terms of numbers, and that will cause some shifts of distribution in that continent.
Carl Haub, a researcher and demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, speaking to us from Washington. The report is titled The 1993 World Population Data Sheet. The questions of how to control our growth rate and how changes in one region affect another region will be taken up next year at the International Conference on Population and Development, sponsored by the United Nations in Cairo, Egypt. The road to the future starts here. This is Bruce Robertson. So what is the point of having a compost pile anyway? Last week, you may remember, we visited Larry Somke, who was rooting around in his compost pile. He showed us how well the compost was turning to soil. This week, we pay a visit to find out what to do with this soil. Larry is in his garden running a small rototiller.
Morning, Larry. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, Bruce. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing today?
Good enough. What are you up to?
Well, I'm just rototilling some compost into my garden.
That's a really handy little rototiller, sort of a handheld almost.
Yeah, this is just a little one designed for smaller beds like I have here on the side of my house. I have a bigger tiller for my big vegetable garden.
I see. Now, this soil looks really exquisite, very dark and full of organic matter.
Well, that's because I've been adding organic matter to this every year. One of the secrets of having a beautiful, easy garden is to not treat your soil like dirt. Every year you have to add 2 to 4 inches of organic matter. Compost is the best, or you can use composted manure, humus, shredded leaves, grass clippings, even peat moss. Peat moss is kind of low in organic matter, but every year put it in there and then you can have a real good garden.
Now, is this the soil that was in your compost bin last time?
Well, it was. It was the compost that was in there, and last fall it was leaves and grass clippings and kitchen scraps, and now this year, after about 6-7 months, it's beautiful, wonderful compost. I've just emptied my compost bin today and put it in here, and I've just saved myself about $30 if I had to go out and buy the organic matter at a lawn and garden center.
So tell us again why you're putting this on the garden and rototilling it in.
Well, soil needs organic matter. It's one of the key elements of soil. And if you put organic matter in there, and it will loosen the soil, it will make the soil more water retentive, the plants will be able to grow there a lot better, and you'll be creating an environment that allows the good guys to come live in your garden. And by that I mean the good bugs who will eat the bad bugs, the snails, not the snails, but the snakes, the toads, the birds, all the good guys will feel, and worms. The wonderful worms, all the good guys will come live in your garden, create an environment that will mean you'll have very few insects, very few diseases, and your garden will be much more water retentive.
Now, it's important with this little rototiller here, or if you're doing it by hand, it's important to fold it into the existing soil.
Yeah, you want to dig down into your soil when you're adding organic matter, like 6 inches, maybe 8 inches, if you can do it. But if you can just get it in there four inches, that's good. Just incorporate it in there, because the organic matter will continue to decompose, the microorganisms will continue to live there, and it will all by itself change the soil structure and make your garden more environmental.
Now, is there anything else you have to add to or mix with the compost that came out of the bin going into the soil here, or is this composted new soil really the best thing that the plant could have?
Well, the compost is wonderful, but you also need to do a little soil test, which is you're testing the chemical balance of the soil. A soil test is no more difficult than an early pregnancy test. You know, you can get them for about $8 at your cooperative extension office. Now is also a very good time to add lime if your pH balance, your chemical test, your soil test tells you to do that. It's also a very good time to add fertilizer. I've already spread some fertilizer on here. I use a balanced natural organic fertilizer, and then dig all of that stuff in, and you're just about ready to plant.
So once again, this composted soil, this homemade soil here, what we're looking at, what you're folding in, is the result of about 6 or 7 months worth of biodegradation here.
Right, and the I put all my leaves in there last year. I shredded them up as much as I could. I've been putting kitchen scraps in there, you know, banana peels, coffee grounds, paper towels, all kinds of stuff has been going in there over the year. It froze during the winter, but in the spring it warmed up. The microorganisms came back to life, and they do all the work for you. All we have to do is put it in a compost bin, then the microorganisms do all the work and turn it into compost.
So by summer's end, your gladiolas and your clematis and all of the plants that you have in your perennial and annual garden here will be just as healthy as could be.
Yeah, and you know, one of the other things I've done now is I have more leaves left over from last year, and I'm starting a new compost bin now. And so in about 2 or 3 months, because it's nice and warm, I probably have some more compost to put out there in maybe July or August. It's a great time to put out more compost. It acts as a mulch, a natural mulch that will keep the water in, and it just really makes the garden much richer and easier to grow in.
Well, Larry, your garden is starting to shape up and look really healthy. What are we going to be doing next week?
Well, I think we ought to take a look at our lawn, and because one thing I want people to know is that a lawn is really a garden too, and rather than just having 6 or 8 tomato plants in a garden, a lawn is millions and millions, or as Carl Sagan would say, billions and billions of tiny little plants growing in there. So we're going to take a look at our lawn next week.
Okay, well, we'll see you next week then.
All right. I think I'll get back to work now.
Good enough.
See if I can get this thing started.
Okay, bye-bye.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener and noted author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. As we said, next time we'll talk about lawns. From Hollowville, New York, this is Bruce Robertson. When it comes to developing energy-efficient lighting, Johnson Controls Incorporated has been given the green light by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. A Milwaukee-based manufacturer of building energy control systems, Johnson Controls has won the first Green Lights Ally of the Year award given by the EPA. Douglas Decker, Manager, Government Affairs at Johnson, says Green Lights is a cooperative program between the federal government and the private sector to upgrade our nation's lighting technology.
Many of the lighting systems that are in the commercial buildings in the United States have been put in 20 years ago, and what they do is they produce light, but they don't produce it efficiently. And so under the program of cooperation between corporations and government, we've joined together in a program that is comprised of both allies and partners. Allies are lighting managers and manufacturers that help partners implement and upgrade lighting plans. What the partner pledges to do is install energy efficiency lighting whenever it's profitable and where the quality of the lighting is maintainable or improved.
Johnson Controls is in the business of designing and manufacturing energy-efficient lighting systems. Decker says by using their own technology, his company has proved a penny saved is a penny earned.
In our own facilities, we have 10 million square foot of office space, and we've already realized a $340,000 a year savings in that 10 million square foot of office space.
By winning this award, Johnson Controls is now called upon to supply technical assistance to other firms wanting to implement systems with the same results.
We go in and audit a building to determine how efficient the lighting is in the facility. And what we find is that we can replace the lighting fixtures in the facility with more efficient ones and have a payback of 2 to 3 years for that investment.
Green Lights program, as Decker mentioned, has established a series of special relationships. A Green Light ally is a company that has efficient technology or know-how. A Green Light partner is one interested in developing a more efficient system. The partner will call on the expertise of an ally. Decker says there are 359 allies across the country, providing assistance to 428 interested partners, companies such as Amoco, Nike, Union Camp, and Southwire. Decker says with utility costs ever going up, more and more companies will be inquiring about a partnership to find out more.
The basic tenet is that it just is a good business investment. And when corporations are going to determine what to invest in, this is a very easy thing to make an investment in, and it's very low risk.
The Environmental Protection Agency set up this program as an extension of federal government policy of leading by example. In the case of Johnson Controls, Decker says his company, by winning this award, comes round full circle. Decker himself has testified on Capitol Hill about his company's energy-efficient technology and techniques, and this testimony went into the crafting of the federal guidelines for building efficiency. In fact, Decker says he recently went back to the White House itself for a special briefing.
This is actually for Earth Day, and it outlined all of Clinton's new programs for greening the White House and those kinds of initiatives, including things like the EPA Green Lights program.
What did the president say about what he's going to do for the White House?
Well, funny you should ask. There was just a meeting today held on the White House, and they're looking at a whole series of things, including addressing the old executive office building. If you know how the White House is organized, they have a west wing and an east wing, and the old executive office building, and then they have a thing called the White House proper, and that's really the president's residence. And they just talked about the different programs that they're going to go through, repairs and replacement of roofing systems, kind of a weather stripping of it. They're going to replace air conditioning units, finishes. They just have a number of retrofit projects that they're looking at to make this a model for the nation. What the president basically said is that he wants to start with his own house and get his own house in order in terms of energy efficiency.
President Carter made history by installing a series of solar photovoltaic panels on the White House roof, panels that were taken down by President Reagan and stored in the basement, where they literally are collecting dust. Any plans for getting them out? Decker says,
I can tell you that I think that people, that technology is further along than when Jimmy Carter originally did this. I think he was really before his time. And I think that what happened is we went with some things that denoted a sacrifice by people. And this was not pleasing. And I think the American public kind of resented that. They turned off all the lights in Washington. And what I think the Clinton administration is trying to do is take and work on things that are proven technologies. Not that solar isn't, but I think solar has to be applied in the proper way so that it's maintainable and it's cost-effective.
Douglas Decker, Manager, Government Affairs with Johnson Controls Incorporated, a company with $5 billion in sales annually with 48,000 employees worldwide. Decker spoke to us from corporate headquarters in Milwaukee. Johnson Controls, winner of the first annual Green Lights Ally of the Year Award from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Johnson previously received a Certificate of Environmental Achievement from Renew America for efforts to promote and establish a national energy conservation ethic. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the show and will join us next week at this time. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, address your questions and your comments both to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. You can pay with MasterCard or Visa or send a check. The number once again is 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show program number 176. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.